You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, a Wisconsin veteran was raped during her time in the military. Now she's turned her story into a play to explore the issue of sexual assault in the armed forces.
First, President Trump had an interview with the publication that he has long criticized yesterday, the New York Times. The president expressed frustration with the ongoing Russia probe and criticized his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions.
Sessions should have never recused himself. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me before he took the job and I would have picked somebody else.
Mm-hmm. He gave you no heads up at all in any sense?
Zero. Okay. So Jeff Sessions takes the job, gets into the job, recuses himself. I then have, which frankly, I think is very unfair to the president.
The president's statement was a public break from one of his staunchest supporters. Sessions responded today saying that he would continue to serve in his position, quote, as long as that is appropriate.
Barry Burden joins us now to tell us more about how the Russia investigation is impacting the White House. He's a professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. Barry, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how unusual does it strike you as being that the president would be so openly critical of his attorney general?
Well, there's a lot that's unusual about this interview. It's amazing that the theme this week from the White House is Made in America. I think that's been stepped all over by other things that are happening, including this surprising interview. It really is surprising that he spent as much time as he did in the interview criticizing his own Department of Justice officials. Jeff Sessions was a loyal campaign spokesperson when Trump was running for president, was one of the first appointments, and obviously stepped aside as part of this recusal. But Trump then went on to criticize his deputy, Rod Rosenstein, who has helped to appoint the special counsel. Trump also criticized the special counsel, Robert Mueller, and others. And as you heard in that clip, described all of this as unfair. So it really was a lot of criticism of a branch of government that he oversees, so it's a complicated relationship.
Does he have a point there that if he had known the attorney general would recuse himself from this investigation, he never would have picked him, and that he was hoping for a heads up from Sessions that this would have been the case, and that he was implying there pretty strongly that that would have been the courteous and the right thing to do? Does President Trump have a point? Is this something that Attorney General Sessions should have foreseen and should have talked about up front?
Well, one thing that makes the Trump presidency different is that he draws a careful line between things that most of us think of as precedents or norms or standards of how government operates and what's actually required by the law. So he has a point in that he can apply whatever litmus test he wants for appointing cabinet officials, ambassadors, or anyone else. It's at his discretion. But the norm, the standard, is to let the Department of Justice do its work fairly independently and to respect that. The president has his own personal attorney. There's also a White House counsel. And those people really help support the president as a person and as leader of the executive branch. The Department of Justice is in the executive branch, but is also viewed as having some independent authority. So I think we saw today even a number of Republican senators pushing back on Trump's statements, saying this is really not acceptable, we need to let the DOJ do its work, and in particular, Bob Mueller as the special counsel.
How much political sway does the president airing his grievances like this have with the legal mechanisms that are at play right now around him, including the Russia investigation?
I don't think much. I'm not sure what the benefit of is an interview like this, other than it allows Trump to air his grievances and may help discredit his critics. Mueller has fairly free rein to pursue the investigation where it goes. In the interview, we saw, I think, some veiled threats from Trump that Mueller ought not go too far. He reminded the interviewers that he has the right to remove Mueller from office, and really anyone who's high up in the DOJ, and that he said he didn't want Mueller going into his family and, you know, pursuing the finances of his sons or his son-in-law. He thought that was a step too far, and that might be a case to remove Mueller. So that's one, I think, tangible action that could come out of the interview. But otherwise, it's largely him airing his gripes.
Now, President Trump has already dismissed former now FBI Director James Comey. Let's just play hypothetical now. Let's say he did decide to dismiss the special prosecutor, special investigator, and that would mean he dismissed two of the top officials investigating him. What would that mean?
I think there would be a firestorm in Washington. A number of members of Congress, particularly those in his party, have let the Russia matters go and haven't commented on it, haven't taken action, because they believe it's in the hands of Robert Mueller, and they wanted to let that play out. The Congress itself has a couple of committees, one in the House, one in the Senate at least, who are investigating. There's some, the FBI is looking into this, but I think there's some concern about each of those investigations. And it's really Mueller where we hope the truth will come out in a fair and timely fashion. If Trump were to interrupt that process by removing Mueller and maybe others in the Justice Department, I think you'd see a number of Republican senators, people like Lindsey Graham, Ben Sasse, John McCain, and others, who would come out and say this is completely unacceptable, and they would push the administration to take some different sort of action.
Barry Burton is with us right now, professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison, looking at the president's latest reactions to the Russia investigation and also his recent public criticism of his attorney general, Jeff Sessions. And Barry, you just mentioned Senator John McCain, and news broke recently this week that he's dealing now with brain cancer, which sounds as though it's quite serious. Do you see, McCain has been very vocal during this first 6 months of the Trump presidency. He has often been critical of the president. Do you see this development with John McCain's health impacting politics in Washington?
It does in a couple of ways. One is what you've already mentioned, that McCain has been a critic of the administration. In fact, even from his recovery today, he was issuing statements critical of the administration on changes it's making to Syria policy and arming rebels who have been fighting the Assad regime. I think he'll continue to do that. But to the degree he's absent from the Senate because of his health, I think it makes it more difficult for the Republicans to move health care or tax reform or any of the other priorities, again, that are being covered up by all of the discussion of Russia and Mueller and what the DOJ is doing this week.
Now, we've had some response to President Trump's interview. Attorney General Sessions said he would continue to serve. It was a very short statement, something like, I'll continue to serve as long as it is appropriate. We haven't heard anything public that I've heard, at least, from Investigator Mueller. Is that the norm for him to kind of keep his head down and keep working?
Yes, and I think that's what's earned Mueller trust from both sides of the aisle. He has a long record in Washington of doing serious nonpartisan work. He's a trusted resource, I think, for just about everyone, and he's not been in the news since his appointment as special counsel. He's been working behind the scenes and collecting information and bringing people on board to help him conduct it. So I think that's why you've got both Republicans and Democrats wanting to trust that process and get off of this topic and on to other things, particularly Republicans who have a legislative agenda they'd like to push.
Now, the president said outright that he thought it would probably be going too far if Robert Mueller would investigate the financial dealings of his son and his son-in-law. Does he have any legal grounds there, or is that fair game for the investigator?
I don't know of legal grounds that would allow him to draw those lines. He is the president, and he can draw the line wherever he wants arbitrarily and remove Mueller at any point. But if you remember the investigations that went on, say, during the Clinton administration, that started with a land deal in Arkansas, which became the Whitewater affair, but ended up with Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton's personal relationship with her. So these investigations do tend to be open-ended and bring in a variety of strands that maybe aren't expected at the outset.
So I want to ask you about the interview itself with the New York Times. Now, the president has been really critical of the New York Times, and the White House press briefings have been getting closed down to some extent, not allowing cameras at many briefings. And here's the president sitting down for this pretty expansive interview with the Times, this outlet he's been very critical of. What do you make of that?
Well, I think he wanted to air his views, and in particular these complaints about the investigation and the allegations about his campaign potentially being connected to Russia in some way. It's gotten very close to him because of the revelations about Donald Jr. being involved in a meeting last summer with some Russian lawyers and entertainment folks. So I think he's concerned about it. It's an ongoing grudge for him, and something that's really consumed his presidency and gotten in the way of other things he'd like to pursue. There's also a sense of that he's sort of lonely in the White House. I think Maggie Haberman, who was one of the reporters in that interview, has discussed in the past that he's sort of by himself, but he craves company and likes sharing his views and wants to express his opinions, and so he sometimes, in an impromptu fashion, just invites folks in for conversation.
Barry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
That was Barry Burden from the UW-Madison joining us to look at the president's latest reactions to the Russia investigation and his public criticism of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. A Wisconsin veteran has turned her story of sexual assault and those of other survivors into a play addressing military sexual trauma. That play will be staged in San Diego this weekend.
Central Time executive producer Judith Sears Poisson spoke with Rachel Carter earlier this week, and we'd like to let listeners know that this may not be appropriate for young or sensitive listeners.
I wanted to start with asking what first drew you to serve in the military.
Sure. I came from an international upbringing. My mother and her side of the family is from England. And when I was younger, I was very close to my grandfather on my mother's side. But unfortunately, when I was 8, he passed away, and I took it very, very, very hard as a child. Later on, when I turned 16, my dad said, you know, I want to take you over to our safety deposit box at the bank. When we got there, he got the box open. He handed me this envelope that was obviously quite a few years old, and you know, and it had my name on it. And when I opened it up, there was this 12-page letter to me that was done on a typewriter from my grandfather when I was just 1 year old, about his experiences in World War II as a gunner for the British Army. And it was just this kind of magical letter that, you know, I actually found out a couple years ago, he had never talked about the war to anybody else but me. Going back to when I was 16, it was just, you know, it was just something, well, wow, you know, I could do this. I could join the military. And it was, for me, it was a way to feel connected to him. So that is why I decided that I wanted to join.
And so you joined, but what happened to you in 2004?
Well, when I got to advanced individual training, so it's when you've moved on from basic training and you get trained in your MOS, your job. And for me, that was broadcast journalism. I was sexually assaulted by another service member. I didn't report it right away because I didn't think that anybody would believe me. You know, I just got done with basic training, so I got trained in hand-to-hand combat and everything else. You know, I just didn't think anybody would believe me that it had happened. But after, you know, a month or two of, you know, being in the same barracks building, going to, you know, chow hall, seeing them at, you know, the school, it just got to be too much that I decided to report, which unfortunately was probably one of the worst decisions that of my life. It was victim blaming, hours over numerous days, just putting it all on me as if it was all my fault, and then I was forced to drop the charges. So it was a very unsettling and unfortunate incident that just steered me off from this dream and this hope that I had.
And under what circumstances did you then leave the military?
So when I was being, you know, when I was going through this investigative process, you know, they told me that if I wanted to continue, you know, and try to press charges, that I would have to go through a lie detector test. And if it was determined that I was lying, which they were very certain I was, then in fact I would be charged and, you know, have to, you know, deal with being kicked out of the military and, you know, that sort of thing. But they said, you know, if you drop the charges, this will just go away. You can go to your first duty station. You know, and they just kept putting the pressure on for me to do that. And I thought, okay, you know, maybe I can move past this. Maybe this is just, you know, a bad situation, but I can get out of it. So I dropped the charges. But unfortunately, then I was written up for fraternization, which followed me on my record. But I was just like, okay, you know, I'll get away from AIT. I'll get to my first duty station. It'll be fine. I'll just try to get help and move on. And I really wanted to be a broadcast journalist. I really wanted to honor my grandfather's memory. It meant a lot to me. So I was really excited when I got my assignment to South Korea. But unfortunately, what they did was they labeled me as having a personality disorder and also being bipolar. So they didn't want to admit that I had been assaulted. They wanted to try to say that it was all me. But I really wanted to push through it. I really wanted to try to be in the military. I actually ended up being a really good broadcaster. But then things kind of fell apart when my rapist ended up getting stationed in Korea. Mm. And I had a sergeant major who was very supportive, but my sergeant, right above me was not, and would say that, I should just get over it and that I was a poor soldier, and I'd just call me names and humiliate me. And it just got to the point where I told my sergeant major that I couldn't do this anymore, that I was just losing respect for the uniform. And luckily, he understood what I was going through and was just seeing how I was just being failed in so many ways that he helped me get out on an honorable discharge.
We're talking with Rachel Carter. She's an Army veteran and the author of the play Speaking Out, Why I Stand, which deals with the topic of military sexual trauma. And Rachel, let's fast forward several years. How sure. did you decide to use theater to tell your story and that of other victims and survivors of military sexual trauma?
So, for 6 years, I didn't even realize that I was a veteran. I was told I wasn't. And I was made to think that I was the only one that this had happened to, that it was my fault, and that, that their sexual assault wasn't a problem in the military. And it wasn't until I came across this documentary called The Invisible War that I realized, whoa, I'm not the only one. And whoa, this has been going on for a really long time. And what the heck? Nobody is talking about it. No, nothing is getting done. And it was a really big wake-up call for me where I felt relieved and angry and sad and all these emotions at the same time. And I came across Service Women's Action Network, and the next year they were having a summit in D.C. And when I got out there, that was the first time I had ever talked to another survivor. And I was hearing all these stories, and it was just mind-boggling how no one was talking about it, how our voices weren't being heard. And I just thought to myself, why don't we try to get stories together in a theater project? Kind of like, just putting these monologues together and getting it up on the stage for people to come and listen to, because I think art is just a great way to get messages across, especially with social justice.
And you talk about being able to talk with other survivors, but I was really struck that not everyone does survive this experience. I'm thinking especially of Carrie Noling. Can you tell us her story?
Unfortunately, Carrie was sexually assaulted in the military and, was forced on medication, discharged from the military. Her father, Gary, didn't know why she was coming home. He was just really happy that she was coming home and was excited to go pick her up. And 5 days after she came home, she was dead. And it wasn't until after that he went through her journals and found out that she had been raped, that she had been blamed, that she had been victimized, kicked out of the military. And it's just a really sad story that unfortunately is not uncommon, that there are a lot of sexual assault victims out there that are being punished, and we're losing them.
Mm-hmm. And we should also note that this is not just something that happens to women.
No.
Men are also victims.
Men are also victims. And, of course, there's this myth that it's only homosexual men that are getting assaulted. It does not matter what a victim's sexuality or gender is. Sexual assault happens to anyone.
Let's listen to a short clip from the play.
You grab me by the ankles, pull me over the ditch by the armor barracks, by the installation fence. I could hear the soldiers coming back to their rooms. I was paralyzed. I always thought I would fight, fend him off with car keys stuck between my fingers. I looked up at the tree branches. My watch said it was 21:47. That was the last time I prayed to God.
Whose story is that we just heard a part of?
So that is a story from a survivor who was assaulted. She was just going with somebody she didn't really know too well, but just wanted to go and have a cigarette and have a little drink and hang out. And the next thing you know, she got assaulted, and she just couldn't believe it. When you join the military, you are taught from day one that the people around you are your family, that even if you don't know them that well, they're wearing a uniform, you're supposed to have their back, and they're supposed to have your back. You don't think that this sort of thing is going to happen.
And this weekend, your play, Speaking Out, Why I Stand, is going to be performed in San Diego. And San Diego has a large military presence. Does that give the performance added significance for you?
I think so. I have actually worked a lot with different military bases on helping train service members and also sexual assault coordinators on military sexual trauma and the long-term effects. The great thing about this theater project that I really like is these are all true stories and poems. These are their stories.
Mm-hmm. And Rachel, as we wrap up, have you seen any progress on how the military deals with sexual assault since your own experience now more than 10 years ago?
Now there's sexual assault programs. They're not perfect, but when I was in, there was nothing. There was no sexual assault response coordinators. There was no programs like there are now. I will say since start of this project and working, you know, with sexual assault response coordinators, there are definitely a lot more supportive people. And I think there is hope that there's progress to be made and that things will change. It just takes time.
Rachel, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Rachel Carter is an Army veteran and the author of the play Speaking Out, Why I Stand, which deals with military sexual trauma. She spoke with Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson earlier this week. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
The Supreme Court announced yesterday that it would leave in place a lower court's order saying that the travel and immigration ban from the Trump administration would need to exempt family members like grandparents from the ban. Originally, only relatives like parents, spouses, and children were allowed by the State Department. While many people are celebrating this as a victory, other people, such as refugees from war-torn areas, are still banned from entering the United States.
Shobha Siva Prasad Wadia joins us now. She's an expert on immigration law and the Samuel Weiss Faculty Scholar and Clinical Professor of Law at Penn State University. She's also the founder and director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic. Shobha, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we pick apart the paragraph order that came down from the Supreme Court yesterday, let's do a quick refresher. What is the travel order and what does it do?
Sure. So this all originates from remarks made by the president on the campaign trail to announce and implement a total shutdown of Muslim immigration to the United States. And sure enough, 1 week after inauguration on January 27th, the president signed his first executive order on a travel ban suspending refugee processing and the entry of all persons from 7 countries with Muslim populations of more than 90%. The first executive order also indefinitely suspended Syrian refugee admissions. And there was a lot of litigation and courtroom traffic blocking the most controversial portions of this travel order. Rather than deal with that in short term, the president revised and signed a second travel ban or Muslim ban on March 6th. 2017, and maintained many of the same controversial provisions, especially as it related to the suspension of nationals from Muslim-majority countries, one exception being Iraq, and as it related to the 120-day suspension of refugee processing. And this second executive order or travel ban also went to the courts. It went to a court in Hawaii as well as to Maryland. These were the most prominent cases They were then appealed to federal circuit courts and then went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so the Supreme Court has already made a message about this ban on June 26th and sent another message, which we can get into during the show as you like, yesterday.
And remind us again what countries are still currently under this travel and immigration ban.
Sure. So according to the ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court on June 26th, any person from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen who lacks a bona fide relationship to a person or an entity is banned from entering the United States. In addition, any refugee from any country who lacks a similar bona fide relationship is banned.
And you mentioned these specific countries are being singled out because of their Muslim population.
Well, this is one line of argument, and it's the position I hold. These are countries that have Muslim populations of more than 90%. I think if you connect that with the various statements that have been made about Muslims, both pre and post Inauguration Day, and you couple that with the many successful arguments about how this order violates the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, you clearly do see a religious animus, in my view.
The word bona fide has come up again and again in terms of what family members can be allowed into the country. What are some of the issues that we get when we look at relatives here?
The first moment I read the per curiam ruling from the Supreme Court on June 26th and saw that they had created this bona fide relationship test, I knew that what was going to come next was this unleashing of uncertainty and murkiness around what constitutes a bona fide relationship. The Supreme Court used a few examples. For example, it said that a close family relationship like a spouse or a mother-in-law or a relationship to an entity like a student's relationship to a university could qualify as a bona fide relationship. But we really didn't have a lot of information or detail hours before this partial ban was to be reinstated on June 29th. The administration, through the Departments of Homeland Security and State, issued guidance on what they believe is bona fide. And this led to a lot of controversy, as you alluded to. The first iteration by the agency excluded fiancés, grandmas, grandpas, aunts, uncles, nieces from the bona fide relationship label, and also called into question refugees who have a formal assurance from a refugee resettlement agency. This made the plaintiffs in Hawaii and other members of the public unhappy and puzzled about the gap between the Supreme Court's ruling and the agency's interpretation. And so we saw another round of litigation leading to yesterday's short paragraph order by the U.S. Supreme Court adopting a broader understanding for what constitutes family and a bona fide relationship to a person, but at the same time conceding or putting the ball, if you will, in the Ninth Circuit's court to decide whether or not a assurance from a refugee resettlement agency constitutes a bona fide relationship with respect to refugees.
We're talking right now with Shobha Siva Prasad Wadia. She is an expert on immigration law and the Samuel Weiss Faculty Scholar and Clinical Professor of Law at Penn State University. She's also the founder and director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic. We are looking at the travel and immigration ban, the twists and the turns of it, and what came down as late as yesterday from the Supreme Court in a one-paragraph paragraph order, there were two parts of this paragraph that some saw was a partial win, Shoba, for the Trump administration. The other part on refugees, not so much. Break down this order for us.
Sure. A good question. And I think that you framed it as I would, that the win, if you will, was for families and for agreeing and recognize that grandparents are the epitome of a close family relationship, or the term bona fide. And so the court adopted a broader understanding for family. And so now someone who is from one of these six countries, for example, who is seeking entry and has a connection to a grandma, grandpa, aunt, or uncle would be exempt from the travel ban. But the loss, really, and the disappointment is with regard to refugees. You know, those who are refugees are fleeing severe harm, which we call in U.S. law persecution, at the hands of the government for a specific reason. And they're fleeing for their lives. And we have a system where refugees who are outside the United States may have a contact or a relationship with a refugee resettlement agency here. And to ignore that relationship or to ban these refugees, even if they have this assurance from a refugee resettlement agency, is certainly concerning and troubling. I expect that the plaintiffs in Hawaii will be explaining to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals about how that should be read, and also support a Hawaii court ruling that recognized this relationship.
And at the end of that paragraph, several justices thought the ban should be brought back without changes. What can we read into that? Are we seeing a pretty clear divide happening here on the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I think we're seeing both a lot of ping pong, right, from court to court, as well as great divide. I mean, you might even call the June 26th ruling, the partial stay, also a bit of a split ruling by creating this bona fide test. I think the fact that Justices Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch yesterday would have stayed the entire Hawaii District Court order does raise meaningful questions of what the court will do in October, because separate from all of this is a decision that the Supreme Court made to hear the case and the legality of this ban during the fall October term. And it did so by granting certiorari, which is a second decision it made on June 26th. I wish I had multiple crystal balls. I think we are in for the possibility of split decisions and a lot of hypothesis on what the outcome might be.
It's been interesting as a bystander watching lower courts stand up, take the lead on fighting this, specifically Hawaii, U.S. District Judge Derek Watson and his ruling, and really taking this to task, so to speak, in non-legalese there. What can we make of how states are fighting this?
I think there have been some fairly poetic and strong narratives by both the district courts and the appellate courts around this litigation, by Judge Watson and also by the appellate courts. I think at one point Jonathan Swift was quoted in one of these rulings, and I think that this teaches us that this is a debate that is not just about the law, but also about people. And, you know, when I think about the first cable by the Department of State excluding all of the extended family members that I personally was in contact with and celebrating in the last 8 weeks, that really raises fundamental questions not only about the law and jurisprudence that recognizes family in a much broader way, but also culture and identity. So I think on a lot of different lanes and threads, the agency got it wrong the first time in how it judged bona fide relationship.
We're talking to Shobha Sivaprasad Wadia. She's an expert on immigration law and the Samuel Weiss Faculty Scholar and Clinical Professor of Law at Penn State University.
You can join us by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Supreme Court's order to let the travel ban stay in place for now as it is? Do you support the travel ban? Is your family impacted? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment over on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. We're continuing our conversation about the Supreme Court's order yesterday to let President Trump's travel ban remain in place for now with some restrictions. And we're speaking with Shobha Sivaprasad Wadia. She's an expert on immigration law and the Samuel Weiss Faculty Scholar and Clinical Professor of Law at Penn State University.
And you can join the conversation by calling in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the travel ban? What message do you think it sends to the rest of the world? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Shobha, you're the director of an immigrant rights clinic. On the ground, what are you hearing and experiencing from people whose lives are at stake from this travel ban?
Well, I am situated at Big Ten University. It is the fourth most affected university by the first version of the travel ban. I think that the immigration agenda by the current president, travel ban and beyond, has had a significant impact on the communities we serve. We have engaged in a number of information sessions and screenings of individuals who are potentially impacted and answered scores of questions about what the ban and other executive orders that have been signed by the president mean for the fate of individuals and families. It's a very uncertain time for students, scholars, dreamers, individuals who are undocumented, individuals who look like they're undocumented, and so on.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to John in Janesville. Hi, John.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm for the ban, and I just feel that it should be stronger than what it is. We have to protect our borders from undesirables. But more importantly, there's a fuller system. Otherwise, why don't we take the whole world then and see what would be left of this country? I'm really for the ban, and I hope that the Supreme Court holds it up. The American people voted Trump in. The American people have spoken. There's some people who just don't want to realize that the American people are for Trump and for his ban.
Shobha, what do you make of what John is saying, that this doesn't go far enough and shore up the borders?
Yeah, so I really appreciate the point. As a immigration attorney and law professor, I believe in the rule of law. We need to have an immigration system that works, and we have the right as a nation to know who is coming into the United States and who is exiting. I think, in my view, the fatal flaw with this travel ban is that we have not seen any relationship between national security and the thrust and content of the travel ban. In fact, several former national security experts filed an amicus brief in the course of this litigation saying just that. We also received, during the course of the litigation around both travel bans, an intelligence report suggesting that citizenship is not a likely indicator for who our next terrorist or national security threat might be. Secondly, I would say that we have a legal question that needs to be answered. we have a constitution and no president can be above the constitution. The establishment clause of the First Amendment teaches us that the government cannot favor one religion over another. And in courtroom after courtroom, you know, judges have really seen a string of events and applied longstanding tests on whether or not this clause is being violated to suggest that it may, in fact, be in violation. There's also been an interesting statutory argument challenging the travel ban originating from a section of the Immigration and Nationality Act. It might be too gritty for this call, but beyond the important policy questions, I think we have these national security and legal ones that are unanswered, and that leaves us with the question of, you know, what are the goals and are we meeting them through this ban?
Well, John, thanks so much for calling in. Let's now go to Peter in Stevens Point. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Okay, just a couple quick things. Number one, my great-grandparents came over here from Norway and came to Ellis Island. And I'm tearing up a little bit because it's emotional. They remember the words on the Statue of Liberty. Bring me your poor, your downtrodden. And in my family, and I know in many families today, especially ones maybe from immigrant countries, grandparents are an extremely important part of the family situation. Now, we, every major holiday, we spent with grandparents.
And so how, Peter, do those abiding words on the Statue of Liberty speak to you today? Do you feel like we're following them as a country?
No way, I'm sorry. It scares me. It literally scares me. I used to live on Staten Island, and I could see the Statue of Liberty from my apartment.
Well, and I'm going to jump in here because we're short on time. Shoba, the travel order is supposed to be temporary. Do we see an end to this at any point?
I don't see a real end as it relates to the administration's assault on immigrant communities and in particular Muslims and refugees and other vulnerable populations. Even after a decision is made around this ban, we could see a more permanent order in place. God forbid, if there is an incident on U.S. soil, we could also see a version of this ban on the interior. And I'll also point out that there is still several tools and powers that the Department of State has to implement a so-called backdoor ban through delayed processing, extreme vetting procedures, and so on. So I don't see these issues and the individuals and communities they impact going away anytime soon.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for calling in. And Shoba, thank you so much for taking the time today and breaking this down for us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Shoba Siva Prasad Wadia is an expert on immigration law and the Samuel Weiss Faculty Scholar and Clinical Professor of Law at Penn State University. She's also the founder and director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic. She joined us to talk about the Supreme Court's order not to allow President Trump's travel ban and immigration ban to be implemented for now.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll talk about grilling meat.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.